Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to this December 12th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Today is the 12th day of the 12th month of the 12th year of the current century, as well as the millennium, and the world will not see another 12, 12, 12 for 100 years, providing it survives that long, there are no assurances that it will. Quite apart from the onset of global warming, a challenge to our collective future that the planet's present leaders seem incapable of meeting, we face the continuing prospect of endless wars, that's wars in plural, and in the absence of war, oppression, and injustice. That one of the present centers of war and injustice is the Middle East is something listeners of Takes on the World are well aware of, since a number of my programs and most of my commentaries have been devoted to it. This is going to be another one of those days. Even with the U.S. and NATO considering the risks as well as benefits of intervening in the bloody Syrian civil war and Egypt's new government being challenged for its lack of democracy by many of those who helped bring down the Mubarak regime, the Israel-Palestine conflict returned to center stage last month when Israel launched a brutal 8-day air and sea assault on Gaza, followed by the UN General Assembly overwhelmingly approving Palestine as a non-member state over the opposition of Washington, Israel, and the Israel lobby. In response to this affront to Israel's plan for expanding its borders, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu announced that Israel will construct 3,000 more housing units exclusively for Jews, including filling in the E1 corridor connecting the illegal settler city of Ma'ale Merim to Jerusalem. If completed, this would cut the West Bank in half and eliminate the last possibility of establishing a contiguous Palestinian state of any size in the West Bank, what the Israelis and their supporters refer to as Judea and Samaria, but which the UN now recognizes as Palestine. To speak about these issues at about 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be calling Palestinian-American professor Mazen Kumpsia in Bethlehem, who returned to his birthplace to become active in the struggle against Israel's ongoing occupation and ethnic cleansing. Until I do that, let's look at some other related news that you may not have heard or read, but which I consider important. Let's begin with a report yesterday in the Israeli paper, Haaretz, that, quote, the U.S. will sell munitions worth $647 million to Israel in order to replenish the stock of U.S.-provided weapons used by the Israeli Air Force in its massive bombings in Gaza during Operation Pillar of Defense. The Defense Department notified Congress of the sale on Monday. That's the lead paragraph in the paper's English edition. In reality, as in the past, the term sell is used to disguise the fact that while Israel will be the recipient of the weapons, the unwitting buyers will be the American taxpayers. Also, the operation was not called Operation Pillar of Defense. That was only for English language readers. In Hebrew, it was Operation Pillar of Cloud, referring to the cover provided by God's angels to protect the ancient Jews fleeing from Egypt as described in Exodus, as if the Israeli Jews were the victims and not the Palestinians of Gaza, and the Israeli bomber pilots were God's angels. The arms deal, which is apparently immune from the so-called fiscal cliff, will include 6,900 joint attack munition tail kits, which convert regular bombs into, quote-unquote, smart munitions, which are guided by satellite and allow precise hits on targets. In addition, hey, it's Hanukkah after all, Washington will supply Israel with 10,000 bombs of various sizes, 3,450 one-ton bombs, 1,725 500-pounders, another 1,725 Blue 109 bunker busters, and 3,450 GBU 39, a smaller bunker buster intended, according to the story, for fortified targets with, quote, minimal impact in order to prevent harm to innocent civilians, unquote. Well, you may have heard on NPR yesterday that the number of homeless veterans has gone down, but no figures were given. On any given night in the streets of Los Angeles, there are an estimated 82,000 homeless men, women, and children, 20% of, or 16,000 of whom are U.S. military veterans. Those homeless U.S. vets were certainly not in sight and not on the minds of those attending the annual dinner of the Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces at the Century Plaza Hotel in Beverly Hills the night of December 6th. Led by its most ubiquitous member, billionaire Haim Saban, who put a $3.6 million check into the kitty, the dinner raised $14 million tax-exempt dollars. to comfort those poor little Israeli soldier boys less than a month after Israel's latest air and sea assault on Gaza, which cost it one casualty. This figure almost tripled the previous record of 5 million for the events set last December, which I reported on Takes on the World, and you probably didn't hear about it anywhere else. It might be viewed as a in-your-face response by the wealthy Israeli-loving Jews of Beverly Hills, Bel Air, and Hollywood, who attended the dinner, to the decision the week before by legendary singer Stevie Wonder, who was slated to be the night's entertainment, that his appearance before the FIDF would be inconsistent with his own personal anti-war feelings and his position as a UN quote-unquote messenger of peace. Wonder had come under intense social media pressure to pull out of the event. An online petition calling on him to cancel his performance had garnered more than 3,600 signatures. The petition read in part, quote, "You were arrested in 1985 protesting South African apartheid. Now we ask you, please remember that apartheid is apartheid, whether it comes from white Afrikaner settlers of South Africa or from Jewish Israelis in Israel. Desmond Tutu has recognized that Israel's apartheid is worse than South Africa's. Will you stand with us against apartheid and cancel your performance at the IDF fundraiser?" A second petition, launched by the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, called on Wonder to, quote, "Please continue your legacy of speaking out for the oppressed. Please be a full-time lover of justice by standing on the right side of history and canceling your performance for the Israeli army." Wonder performed at a 1998 gala honoring Israel's 50th anniversary. It took 15 years later, but Stevie Wonder finally saw the light. The prospects for Haim Saban and those attending the Friends of the Israel Defense Force dinners eventually doing the same thing are not promising. Saban, an Egyptian-born Israeli and now an American citizen, became one of the Democratic Party's major benefactors in 2002 when he donated $12.3 million to the party, $7 million of which was used to build its Washington headquarters. In the same year, 2002 was a very good year for Haim, who made his millions producing or distributing the popular Saturday morning kids program, the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. With an additional $12.3 million, he effectively co-opted the Brookings Institution, the last remaining Washington think tank that did not bow down to Israel, and established the Saban Center for Middle East Policy, placing former AIPAC official and U.S. ambassador to Israel, Australian-born Martin Indyk, as its director. I've told you before, of course, that Washington is Israel's most important occupied territory, but unlike the West Bank and Gaza, there are very few overt signs of resistance, let alone recognition of the fact by most of those who claim to support the Palestinians. Outgoing Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who was slated to be the Democratic Party candidate for president in 2016, and if so, she will certainly present no more challenge to Washington's occupier than has Obama. And this was apparent November 30th in her speech at the annual dinner of the Saban Forum, the day that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu announced the building of new housing settlements as housing units as a punishment for the Palestinian successful vote for membership in the U.S. General Assembly. Not one to hide his affections for Israel, Saban made sure that the curtains behind the speaker's table identifying the Saban Forum would be in English and Hebrew. It was a perfect background for Hillary. Clinton's performance did not go unnoticed. In a New York Times column December 5th, headlined Mighty Morphin Hillary, Maureen Dowd took Clinton to task for her abject cowardice. Quote, "Everyone expected Hillary to lower the boom on Bibi, that is Netanyahu, Friday night. The bullying Israeli prime minister is fond of demanding that America set red lines in Iran's nuclear ambitions. But he blithely stuck a finger in the eye of President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton Friday and went over a red line for successive American administrations. Israel gave the White House only a few hours' notice," wrote Dowd, "that it was defying the U.S. and planning new settlements in the most sensitive area east of Jerusalem, a move that Washington fears could obliterate any prospect of a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict." The provocation preceded Hillary's speech at the Saban Forum at the Willard Hotel here Friday night, wrote Dowd. "The conference on the Middle East is run by Haim Saban," she writes, an Israeli-American media entertainment mogul from Beverly Hills who is best known for three things: bringing the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers from Japan to America, being a vocal supporter of Israel, and lavishing the Clintons with donations. He gave $5 million to the Clinton Presidential Library and $5 million to the Clinton Foundation, and avidly supported Hillary's 2008 bid against Obama. Last year, Dowd went on, Hillary infuriated some Israeli ministers when she said she was alarmed about the rights of women and anti-democratic bills proposed by far-right members of the Netanyahu government. She talked about her dismay at learning that some religious Israeli soldiers walked out of events where women were singing and that some buses in Jerusalem operate under gender apartheid, reminiscent of Rosa Parks, as she put it. So many in the audience this time assumed that the outgoing Secretary of State would lay down the law to be beyond settlements. Well, not so. These activities, she said, set back the cause of a negotiated peace. She said the Palestinians could have had a state as old as I am if in 1947 they had made the right decision or if they had worked with my husband in 2000. And she urged Israel to be generous toward the Palestinians, but she didn't whack Bibi as he deserved. Many there came away assuming that it was the beginning of Hillary's 2016 campaign. Her reasoning, they record, writes Dowd, was this: if Obama doesn't want to have anything to do with the settlement issue, if he'd rather spend his time in Myanmar, than Israel, then why should she stir up trouble with Israel and her pro-Israel supporters on her way out the door? And aside from the dog that didn't bark, Maureen Dowd pointed out, there was a video that roared. A film that introduced Hillary featured speakers and Israeli politicians, including Netanyahu, Ehud Barak, Shimon Peres, and Zippy Livni, gushing over the secretary. In a dispatch headlined, "Hillary is Running," David Remnick, the New Yorker editor, wrote, quote, "The film was like an international endorsement for 4 years in advance of the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary." And that's all from Maureen Dowd on December 5th, New York Times. As for U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice, her much-touted replacement, the news is no better. Quite apart from her problems with the Republicans and their obsession with attack on the CIA compound in Benghazi, Democracy Now! Reported that Rice holds up to $600,000 worth of stock in the firm behind the controversial Keystone XL oil pipeline. TransCanada, the company, is seeking federal permission to transport Canadian tar sands oil to the U.S. Gulf Coast. If confirmed, as Secretary of State, Rice could play a key role in determining the fate of the pipeline. And there's more. Rice admits that she is close to the controversial U.S.-trained Rwandan President Paul Kagame, who many observers and former allies believe was behind the plane crash that took the life of Rwandan President Juvenal Habyarimana in 1994 and ignited the Rwandan genocide. She acknowledges that the Kagame government was her client when she worked at IntelliBridge, a strategic analysis center in Washington, along with some other former Clinton administration officials. Now Kagame is charged with and admits to being the power behind the rebel movement M23, which is trying to take over the Democratic Republic of the Congo and committing atrocities while doing so. According to the New York Times, at a meeting at the UN with her British and French counterparts 2 months ago, Rice objected strongly to a call by the French envoy Gerard Araud for explicitly, quote, naming and shaming Mr. Kagame and the Rwandan government for its support of M23 and to his proposal to consider sanctions to pressure Rwanda to abandon the rebel group. "Listen, Gerard," she said, according to an unnamed Western diplomat with knowledge of the meeting, "this is the DRC, Democratic Republic of the Congo. If it weren't the M23 doing this, it would be some other group," end quote. The exchange was reported in Foreign Policy magazine last week. A few weeks later, Rice again stepped in to protect Kagame. After delaying for weeks the publication of a UN report denouncing Rwanda's support for the M23 and opposing any direct references to Rwanda in UN statements and resolutions on the crisis, Rice intervened to water down a Security Council resolution that strongly condemned the M23 for widespread rape, summary executions, and recruitment of child soldiers. The resolution expressed, quote-unquote, deep concern about external actors supporting the M23, but Rice, according to the Times, prevailed in preventing the resolution explicitly naming Rwanda when it passed the resolution November 20th. More than 5 million people have died of wars and disease in the Congo over the last decade, with Washington, as exemplified by Ambassador Rice, doing nothing about it. Rice, however, is not without her supporters. According to the Jewish Weekly, The Forward, quote, facing a group of 400 rabbis affiliated with the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or APAC, Rice opened a speech this past March with her favorite quote from Psalms, and she did it in Hebrew. She conceded, writes The Forward, that she needed to improve her Hebrew pronunciation, but the audience was already won over. As she concluded her address, the capacity-filled room of pro-Israel activists burst into song. The APAC event, wrote The Forward, quote, illustrated the long road that Rice has traveled in her relations with the Jewish and pro-Israel communities, among whom she has earned a reputation as a leading defender of Israel, an international body known for its automatic bias against the Jewish state, end quote. Those are The Forward's words, not mine. I don't know about you, but I think one Secretary of State Rice was more than enough.